President Nicolás Maduro has reiterated the anti-neoliberal character of the revolutionary movement in Latin America. Speaking in Rome, the Venezuelan leader said, "The ongoing revolutionary processes in Latin America towards achieving our region's second and definitive independence are profoundly anti-neoliberal. It is our people's response to centuries of savage plunder of our nations by capitalism." Maduro said that 21st century socialism in Latin America is manifested in many different ways, enriched by the particular distinctive characteristics of each nation where it is being built. The overall goal, however, is the same, building a truly just society.
Branded Edithel, white man heaven, black man hell.
And hello, if you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
I am your white brother, he said, red man. I'll treat you the best. Yet until you push the Indian further west with his white woman and fire water, tricks and lies he stole America. The original owner of this nation is cooped up on a reservation. So my friend, it's easy to tell, white man heaven, black man hell. He needed someone to work the land. His back was too weak. He needed you, black man, so he commissioned Sir John Hawkins to commit the world's most grievous.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
There's a sense of errant anger. People are angry, but they can't explain why.
Hello, sir, and why are you here today?
I'm here to protest, right? Because I'm going on a march because I want Britain to be back British. I want Britain to be back British. Got interracial law. And the Muslimic infidel, they're trying to get their law over our country. And it is happening. It's happening in other countries. Everything is happening in every country. It's like you've got the Iraqi law that they put down in London, like we're more or less near London today. But they're trying to put the Iraqi law down on London. They're just trying to put their law down on us, and we can't stand for that.
Which Iraqi law is this?
It's the Muslimic law. They've got their law. Obviously, it's their law, isn't it? Like, there's no one. We can't do anything about that. But we're just trying to stop Muslimic. We've got Muslimic rape gangs nowadays. Fucking, just 15-year-olds getting raped and everything. It just can't happen. That's why all these people are there. All these people around us, that's why they're there.
Thank you very much.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land!
Indian land!
Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me, Negro. That's nothing.
What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Do you know what white folks call people like you and me in private? Niggers, dogs. Niggers.
C'était Dizen, intelligent de radio.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from the occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutation and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News, thought and analysis concerning the issues that matter to Aboriginal peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, neofascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earth and love and solidarity to the original family in this time of strife and struggle. There's a lot of people hurting out here, and you know, there really doesn't need to be all of this mishigas. It can stop. You know, it can stop when we stop trusting and stop putting our faith into those who we know. You know, we're not talking about conspiracy theories here. Because we know. Do not give a damn about our general welfare. They don't care about the planet. They don't care about the future generations. They don't care about the environment. Depending on which scientist you ask, especially in terms of the environment. You know, what's been done now cannot be fixed. You know, we are now in a science fiction movie of our own making. You know, that's not entertainment any longer. You know, this is the real thing. You know, we now have to prepare for a world in which, carbon is just, all of this is going to have to change. This entire thing, all of this is going to have to change. All of this is going to have to change, or all of it is going to stop. You know, this whole thing will be over. This whole experiment, in terms of humanity, will be finished, and it won't be anybody to blame, you know, other than humanity. You know, I know those of you who believe in a higher power for, you know, whatever, you know, fucking reason, because I've seen, you know, and I'm saying this, you know, again, you know, all of you, you know, some idiot here the other night got in, you know, got into it with me over the death penalty, and then went from the death penalty to, you know, I hate democracy, you know, I hate the country, I hate him, because he's white, and what have you. You know, all of this happened within, I don't know, like 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, that's the Twitterverse, right? And you can follow me if you want to, The Angry Indian on Twitter. One word. You know, I really don't know what the hell his problem is, but you know, it just turned out to be what it usually is: fear, ignorance, seeing what's wrong and not wanting to accept what the hell is going on. You know, living in fucking denial. You know, I mean, there's so many goddamn people who live in fucking denial. But just like everything else now, we take the negative and we turn it into entertainment, right? So, you know, what am I talking about? So, you know, let me make this simple. Because, you know, we were just talking about this before we came in here. Kitchen Nightmares is a perfect example of what the hell is wrong with capitalism, right? You see, you have all of these business owners. They think they know what the fuck they're doing. You know, here it is, that they're coming on to a show called Kitchen Goddamn Nightmares, right? Where you have an English chef, Gordon Ramsay, if you're not into food. And that's another thing. Have you heard about Paula Deen? Right, Lupe, executive producer and your engineer for this evening, as always, Guadalupe Morales. You know, we were coming in here, and we were on the bus at your device went off, and somebody said, "Yeah, have you heard?" Well, we came in here and we started looking around, and it turns out that Paula Deen doesn't think that there's anything wrong with the term nigger. Not the way she uses it anyway, because she doesn't do it in a mean way, you know. Right? Excuse me. You know, she doesn't do it in a mean way. So, when she tells some interview thing, because I don't know, actually it was testimony, I think. I don't know, we read it real quick, we scanned it real quick. Anyway, she was in some film interview or testimony for something. Because is she being sued? I don't know. But in any case, she wanted to have, you know, African folks, you know, black folks, right?
Yeah.
African hyphenate American folks of a certain age group. I guess they had to be, you know, middle age. They were supposed to be plantation slaves for some wedding shindig that she's putting on. So, yeah, Paula Deen. Well, see, I've always hated the goddamn term foodie anyway. I think that's ridiculous. Either you like good food or you don't. But see, everything in America has to be goddamn ruined through capitalism. So you have to now turn it into a fucking meme in which you can now push the utensils, the graters, the, you know, all the accoutrements of this new thing, right? The juicers, all of the food processors, right? There's all these name brands. You know, you can go to Kmart, or you can go to any of these big box shops, and then they'll push them in Africa. You know, people are starving, but, you know, they're pushing this crap over. So, yeah. So, you know, Paula Deen and her racism, you know. And then, you know, food, right? You know, Monsanto. Have you heard this one? If you're an activist who's trying to limit or stop or label, you know, any of those levels, genetically modified food, as far as Monsanto, the CEO, he says that you're the elitist. You know, it's like when I got into an argument with a Klan member one time, which is not a fun, which is not, you know, a fun, it's not an enjoyable experience. It just really isn't. It just really is. And, you know, it was just, you know, I didn't know what to think, you know. And as this cat's mustache was like, you know, fluttering as he was just calling me a nigger and what had, you know, he was like, "You're the racist. You're the racist. You're the racist. You're the racist." I said, "You're the racist." you know, I'm the racist. To say, you know, how the hell am I the racist? You're standing here with, you know, a thing, he has some sign talking about monkeys. You know, referring to, you know, black folks, of course. You know, African people. And I mean, I looked at him, and he just got irate. I mean, you know, nothing happened. You know, there were police all over the place. But he was just going on and on, and you're the racist, you're the racist, you're the racist. You hate me because I'm white. You know, and my wife at the time, we're looking at each other, and it's like, you know, nobody said a damn thing to this guy. You know, he's screaming, 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 screaming. So it's, you know, it's like Limbaugh. You know, he's the victim. He's the victim. You know, have you noticed that? You know, Limbaugh is a victim. Remember when he, what was it, OxyContin? Whatever it is, that stuff they were calling hillbilly heroin. Which, you know, I don't use the term hillbilly because, you know, as far as I've always known and understood, you know, it was pretty offensive. You know, I don't use it. But I suppose what they were implying by that is that that's something that poor white folks use. You know, if crack is supposed to be a black ghetto drug, I suppose OxyContin is what you use in the white ghetto. You know, right, Lupe? You know, it must be. It must be, right? But anyway, I just remember him talking about how anybody who did drugs was low life and that, you know, you should be, you know, treated, you know, with all the weight of the system. And then, you know, after all the years of all of him coming down on the ACLU, what happened? As soon as he got into trouble, after he sent his Latina maid, his pro-white Rush Limbaugh, anti-immigrant Rush Limbaugh, but he has a Latina maid. I don't know where she was from in Latin America, but, you know, he had a Latina maid who was going to the parking lot of a supermarket to pick up his stash, right? To pick up his fix, right? Remember that term? Remember that term? His fix. And as soon as he got into trouble and they were going to bring some of his papers into court, all of a sudden he went to the ACLU. He went to the American Civil Liberties Union, the same American Civil Liberties Union that he was lambasting all of these years. Same thing with the KKK. I'm not talking about the Philippine KKK. I'm talking about the American Ku Klux Klan, right, who were doing their poor man's ripoff of what happened during the Reconquista, you know, in the 1400s. So, yeah. You know, he does dope, and he calls on the ACLU to cover his keister. And then, how many different people did I remember arguing about this? Republicans that I had to work with at the time. Because I used to have to work with the Republican chair, right, in my area at that time. And, you know, they would just, you know, where's your compassion? I'm like, are you kidding me? Compassion for Limbaugh? Compassion for... Look, I haven't had compassion for Rush Limbaugh ever since he had his TV show. I mean, any of you remember that? It used to be on... I saw it on cable. I saw it on cable television. Rush Limbaugh show. Cable television. Where he used to actually get challenged by his guests. And then he used to just collapse. It's like, you know, he would fold. You know, he could not take face-to-face criticism. That's why he does goddamn radio. You know, I mean, he, Glenn Beck, any of them, if they catch a caller that will really catch them, well, I mean, left or right, really, when it comes to radio talk in the United States. I mean, there's some people that will argue with you. There's some that will not. Some can, some can't. You know, Tom Hartman can definitely, you know, make an intellectual argument. Most of these jerks on the right can't. All they can do is yell and tell you that you're un-American and you hate God. You know, you don't like white people. You know, they just go to the non sequiturs because they can't deal with facts. Because if we deal with facts, they have nowhere to stand. You dig what I'm saying? So anyway, so, you know, so Rush Limbaugh, so not only does he go to the ACLU to cover his keister, you then have Republicans who are just fanning out across the universe talking about, well, you need to have compassion for this junk. And you know, usually I have compassion for addicts. But when somebody's like Limbaugh, no, I don't have any compassion for you. See, you know, you're a junk. And I mean that with all due malice. You know, you're a junkie. I have no respect for you. Because see, I'm calling you that because see, you're the type of person that will do whatever to enable for yourself. But then you'll turn in your other ass, right? You know? You're just like the worst type of addict. So, you know, as somebody who's had to deal with this, you know, family members and partners that messed up on some kind of bullshit, you're a junkie. You're a hypocrite and you're a junkie. You know, same thing with Glenn Beck. I don't hold anything against Glenn Beck for having a cocaine problem. And I don't hold anything against him for being a mom. See, I have contempt for him for having no compassion for other people. You know, other than his own goddamn problems. It's like, you know, when he's talked all this nonsense about unions, it was two union nurses when he needed that emergency appendectomy, right? You know, who helped him get through that. You know, no respect. No respect. You know, it's just like when people were coming down on the, I don't want to call him Obama's minister because Obama totally disrespected his minister. But you know who I'm talking about. Old cat out there in Chicago. He's actually doing good work for the people of Chicago. You know, yeah, I can't remember his name right now. You know, they were coming down on him, You know, he was un-American. He hated white people. He didn't like the United States. And it's like, wait a minute, do you understand that this, you're talking to a Marine? Because there's no such goddamn thing as an ex-motherfucking Marine. You're talking to a Marine. Who was also on the surgical team for Lyndon Baines Johnson. I don't know how many of you knew that. He was given a special letter by Lyndon Baines Johnson, which I believe was actually even co-signed by his wife for saving his life. He was part of the surgical team who saved his life. But, you know, no. You know, he's a Marine. He stays in government. You know, saves the life of so many important... doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean anything. You know, doesn't mean anything. Because we know when you're black, whatever you do, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. You know, you can save lives, you can defend the United States, you can defend England, you can defend Australia, New Zealand, right? You can defend France, you can defend Italy, Spain, if you're, you know, one of those that are serving, trying to find a way in those countries. Because no one in Africa you felt would have you any longer. And you saw the mayhem, but then you realized when you got to Europe, you didn't have any other goddamn skills, so you end up doing what? You know? And then there's always the legionnaires, you know? I mean, you have France and you have Spain. You know, they'll take you pretty much when nobody else will take you. You know? So I don't know. You know, why are we even doing this episode? Why even do a dispatch? Because there's nothing positive, goddamn, to say. You know, you can't even talk about food without running into fucking racism. You know, and then you know, I'm not really into science fiction, at least not this new stuff. But you got all these black folks steampunk, Afropunk, right? Right, you know, and it's like, you know, what the hell is going on here? You know, whatever white people do, you got to have a black version, mirror version of it. It's like, what the fuck, man? You know? Yeah, I know. Am I going on tangents? Yeah, you goddamn right. Because just, you know, I'm looking around here, you know, and I can't make any sense of it. You know, we look back at the '60s, and yeah, there was a hell of a lot of confusion. And I wasn't old, and I'm not old enough to say I was really cognizant. To understand what the hell was going on around me. But, I mean, at least there was some cohesion. You know, when I look back, you know, I can see photos and photographs or a film clip or something and say, yeah, you know, that's from the 60s or that's from the 70s. And then, you know, okay, that's the 80s. And then, you know, once the 90s rolled around, all of a sudden nothing's identifiable anymore. You know, haircuts, styles, mannerisms, speech, you know, nothing. 2000, nothing. 2010, absolutely nothing. Then they start regurgitating old, you know, B movie films that nobody gave a damn about when they were first turned out. And then somebody like Quentin Tarantino can become a millionaire and become considered a serious director by rehashing the worst of what was the worst of the past. You know, and then to make things even worse is that, you know, when you have real science fiction, let's say Logan's Run, for example, let's just do a fast one, Logan's Run, you know, where, you know, everybody lived under a dome. Well, it's kind of getting like that, isn't it? And then you couldn't live past a certain age, and you could get all the plastic surgery you want, you know, on demand, right? You can change yourself as many times as you like. And then we can look at the Twilight Zone for that. How many times do we see things like that? I mean, how many different things are we seeing right now in terms of ethics can we trace back to Rod Serling's Twilight Zone? And by the way, Rod Serling is one of the reasons why I started writing. Because it became apparent to me after a while what he was trying to do, at least through his writing. And that inspired me. But, you know, that type of science fiction. I mean, we look at 2001. What questions were being asked? What's happening now? You know, even though it turns out that Arthur C. Clarke was a fucking freak. Now, I guess he and Jimmy Savile are residing in the same level of hell some goddamn where, if you believe in that kind of shit. Yeah, he's another one, you know, a fucking freak. Fucking freak. You know, it's just like, what's his name? I said this before, Allen Ginsberg. I had to walk away from Ginsberg. I had to walk the fuck away from him. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? There's no excuse for this shit. You know, it's like, you can't put your faith in any goddamn. You know, like Bertrand Russell. You know, this, I admire him. I didn't have any faith. You know, I mean, the same thing with Malcolm. You know, I admire Malcolm. I admire Che Guevara. You know, don't put any faith in them. You know, I admire Fidel Castro. You know, I admire Chavez. Don't put any faith in them. Hey, you know, I mean, I admired Evo Morales, but you know, as you can see, it didn't make any sense to be an indigenous person to put any real faith in him, right? You know, same thing with Carrillo said. You know, I did Carrillo, but at the same time, capitalism is going to do what the fuck is going to do, right? And he's got the power, and yes, he's indigenous, but I mean, you know, that's like the argument that was being made in the East Coast in the 70s, when I was young. Well, you know, if black people take over the drug trade from the Italian mafia, then that makes it all good because it's black, right? And then, you know, depending on who you speak to in Oakland, that's supposedly what, you know, co-founder of the Black Panther Party was talking about before he ended up, you know, losing it all on a dark street in Oakland after everything that he had been through. Went from law school to leading a revolutionary organization. You know who I'm talking about, Huey P. Newton. You know, I mean, according to Bobby Seale, who said this on film, on camera. He's on tape. That's a million years ago. Tape. He's on tape. Saying that, you know, his idea was, let us, talking about the Panther Party, take over the drug trade, and then we can kick white people out. And then we can control it and be all good. See, that's what happened to the FARC. Right? And this is why people, people get confused when I say, when you look at the FARC, you look at the Zapatistas, you're not talking about the same goddamn thing. The Zapatistas are trying to keep their young men from getting involved in that sort of thing. The FARC, what do? They will force your young man into that. I mean, is there a political thing about it? Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, there probably was some time ago. Where is it now? I mean, look at Ireland. If you want to look at Europe, and let's get away from brown folks for a second. Let's look at Ireland. You know, what the hell has happened in Ireland? Ireland is now the damn prime capital of Europe. And who's doing most of the goddamn major damage? These are former soldiers from the IRA. Well, one of them. You know, or at least this is what the UK and the Irish news are saying. This is what Interpol is saying. Okay, there's no money in Ireland anymore. The Celtic Tiger, I don't know what happened to it. It got up and ran someplace else. and it just left Dublin and, you know, all of these other areas bereft. And then you got to remember, you know, the whole thing going on between the Unionists and the Republicans over there, that hasn't stopped. That hasn't stopped. And after Steak Knife and, you know, all of the, and Martin Ingram and these all Swedens, of course. And the hell is his name? Y'all know who I'm talking about. He's been on BBC News Night. He's taking UK to court. All that. Well, you know, I mean, who can be believed? Who can be believed? You know, first they were saying in Boston they didn't know these guys. You know, then it turned out they did know them. Then, you know, they had weapons, then they didn't have. And then something happens to this other cat in Florida. Then you got whoa. You know, and I still don't know where the hell to go with that story. Because first they said they didn't know about him. Then it turned out they did know about him. Turned out he was picked up in Africa. Then it turns out he was picked up in Africa by, you know, whom? You know, I mean, no justification for what the hell happened. No justification for what happened. And anyone who justified him is a fucking idiot. You know, I don't give a damn who the hell you are. You're a fucking idiot if you think that kind of thing was cool. It's the same shit that was going on with that Donner cop that was going crazy in the States not too long ago. No justification for what he did. But there was a hell of a lot of confusion behind what the hell happened. We still don't know what the hell went on behind that. And we still don't know what the hell's going on with these other cases because everybody's goddamn lying. So as I said, you know, I mean, what's the point of doing these goddamn shows? You know, because we can sit here and complain and try to analyze and break it down all the hell we want. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If none of us are willing to, you know, simply disengage ourselves from the system, then the system's going to continue. See, you know, that's my action, or that's my suggestion. That's my suggestion, you know, to myself. You do what the hell you want to do. But obviously, you know, in order for all of us to survive, we're going to have to disengage from this and actively start to, you know, build, you know, communal ways of and holistic ways of doing things and seeing things and analyzing things and finding ways to solve situations and making a commitment to solve situations, to do conflict resolution instead of just talking about it. Let's actually do it. And maybe when I come on the mic the next time, I won't be so fucking bitter. This is the Angry Indian. And you are listening to Intelligent Animals Radio.
Well, I could reason from the ends. She burned the marijuana for free of her events. Never left her cause fear. She have a dignity, she has to keep and keep. Although she raised as an uptown girl, she know her roots and her culture. She living in an uptown world, but still an African daughter. She raised as an uptown girl, she know her roots and her culture.
This is a story the Arizona Department of Corrections didn't want you to see and spent thousands of dollars of your money trying to stop us from bringing it to you.
This is hard to watch and even harder to come to terms with because it raises questions about basic human decency. If you or any of us saw someone in trouble, we would offer to help. If you saw a person who was injured and dying, you would do what you could to rescue them and make them comfortable.
But that apparently isn't what happened in an Arizona prison when a mentally ill inmate slashed his throat and wrists. 12 News Watchdog reporter Wendy Halloran has been investigating this story for 2 years, and tonight she has visual evidence of the event. It's hard to imagine, Wendy.
Mark and Lynn Sue, you're going to see a traumatic event not staged for reality TV, but true life and death playing out in a prison cell. Tony Lester was a Native American inmate with severe mental illness. He committed suicide, and the corrections officers who were the first responders did not render aid. Instead, they recorded Tony Lester's final moments on video. If you don't want to see this story, now is the time to turn away.
Lester! Lester!
Tony Lester was a paranoid schizophrenic serving a 12-year prison sentence for aggravated assault. He'd been on suicide watch before, but not July 12, 2010.
Lester!
Lester, help's on its way, okay?
Mistakenly given razors by prison staff, Lester slashed his throat, arms, and groin. When corrections officers got to his cell, the damage was apparent. Lester had even written the word voices in his own blood. Although one of them shot this video, none of the first responders, four corrections officers, appear prepared to help Tony Lester. Carl Torsbins is a retired Arizona deputy warden.
All I saw was people standing back, closing their eyes to what was going on around them, shutting themselves down so they didn't have to deal with the reality of this horror.
Tony Lester is moaning and gasping for air.
The inmate is still breathing.
As precious seconds pass, corrections officers direct their attention away from Lester to what seems obvious.
Looking for a suicide person.
The clock is ticking for Tony Lester.
It's pretty nasty, too.
7 minutes into the taping, paramedics arrive at Lester's cell and take over.
We gotta move fast here, man. We gotta get him down from here.
Corrections officers are asked to help.
We're gonna need your help, guys.
Gotta need some help, man.
Yeah, we're gonna need your help. We gotta get him out of here.
Paramedics look for wounds and try to stop the bleeding. Tony Lester is fighting for his life. But it doesn't stop a corrections officer from wanting to handcuff him.
Let me get some help.
Lester is taken to a hospital where he will die.
Well, what I was shocked by was that they basically just stood around talking. I mean, minute after minute after minute, while this man was bleeding, and as far as they knew, bleeding to death.
Dr. James Gilligan is a nationally renowned expert on the incarceration of the mentally ill. A clinical professor of psychiatry at New York University, Gilligan led the Harvard University team which reacted to an epidemic of suicides and homicides inside the Massachusetts state prison system. I asked him to watch the video.
And I've seen the worst of the worst. I would still say this was a particularly shocking and egregious case of a major life-threatening emergency that was being grossly neglected.
Within days of Lester's death, DOC Internal Affairs Supervisor Phil Schoenig is called in to investigate. Schoenig says he was under a lot of pressure to close this case.
This Lester case
I'm under the gun to get this done. So that's why we're down here. Because normally we get 53 days to get, you know, a death case done, but because we've had four in a week, two homicides and two suicides. The director is just going nuts.
A spokesman for director Charles Ryan denies he ever pressured Shonig to speed up his investigation.
This is unconscionable. This is shocking. And I'm actually angry to see this because I know my brothers and sisters in uniform know better than this.
Since we first reported our story, the Department of Corrections retrained more than 8,000 correctional officers in suicide prevention, suicide response, and first aid. It's a start, but it hasn't significantly reduced the number of suicides in Arizona prisons. Still, for one family, there is small consolation that maybe in death, Tony Lester will make a difference he was never able to make in life.
When he left to the Department of Corrections, and I said my goodbye to him, and he waved at me, and he looked at me, and he said, "Aunt Patty, you've done enough. It's meant to be for me to go to prison. You don't understand now, but in time you will. I understand."
If this was your son or your brother, would you want them treated this way? The Lester family said no, and they asked us to help expose what happened in that cell. The Department of Corrections has fought every step of the way to keep all of us in the dark, spending over $25,000 arguing that this video should not be seen. 12 News went to court and won the case, releasing the video. However, the DOC attorney released this statement. Judge David Talamante granted judgment for the state of Arizona on the claim that ADC officers failed to render proper aid to inmate Lester before the ADC officers arrived at the scene. Inmate Lester's body had lost too much of his blood supply to allow him to survive. At that point, there was little anyone could do to save his life. Now, the DOC is still fighting to defend their conduct in the Lester case. Tony's family is seeking $3 million in damages. Their lawsuit is set for trial in July. In the meantime, three of the four corrections officers you saw in our story are still on the job. But they and all corrections officers have received mandatory training in how to handle these situations. Wendy Hunt.
I don't know more. All is from the
You are listening to Aboriginal Press News Service Public Radio, Indigenous Talk Radio for Celtic Scotland and other people living in the fourth world.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
Come on, come on.
I don't know more.
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian Health Service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the seven generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan! We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs! We don't have to have a reason to hate it. People need to get off your ass and wake up! This is America!
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Well, what the bloody hell are you then?
The most feared species in all Africa, a Kaffir who cannot be broken.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Before Canadians presume moral superiority in relation to the racism of the U.S. prison system, we need to examine some astounding figures in this country. First Nations people comprise 4% of the total population, but they are 20% of the prison population. Consider the present reality of imprisoned women. 1 in 3 women in federal prisons are Aboriginal, and over the last 10 years, representation of Aboriginal women in the prison system has increased by nearly 90%. Despite representing 6% of the female youth population in Canada, 44% of the female youth in custody are Indigenous. And the current government's tough-on-crime mantra can only worsen this gross discrimination. With this in mind, we turn to the situation in the United States. Cultural anthropologist Wendy Marshall recently wrote an article titled White Supremacy and Mass Incarceration. We reached Wendy in Philadelphia to discuss the situation in the U.S. Welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, Wendy.
Thank you, Peter.
Wendy, right-wing Republicans like Newt Gingrich say there is an urgent need to address the astronomical growth in the prison population. What's the motive behind this concern among the right wing?
You know, I can't really say for sure what the motive is of the right wing, but it looks to me like it's a concern about preserving profits in the sort of prison industry. The profit margins of corporate private prison providers have been decreasing in recent years, aren't nearly as high as they were at the beginning of the whole privatization rush. So I think there's this way that, you know, people who care about the bottom line of prison industry profits are looking at the ways that they can capture profits without warehousing people in big old prisons. In some places, they're doing privatized sort of halfway houses for nonviolent offenders. But the houses are controlled by corporations that are doing it for profit.
Do they ignore the racial disparities?
I mean, if you read any of the, like, the, in terms of the research I did for this piece in Al Jazeera, there's no discussion of race, of racism, of white supremacy, in the consideration of why there needs to be some kind of criminal justice system reform.
Let's go back to 1987. In your article, you discuss a Supreme Court decision called McCleskey versus Kemp, and you say that that decision showed just how saturated with racism the justice system is. Why do you say so?
Well, if you if you look at in the Al Jazeera article, I talk a lot about what the majority opinion was like in the McCleskey v. Kemp thing case. And although the defense had tried to present all this evidence about racial bias in sentencing and in the death penalty, the court refused to. On one hand, they validated the research, but they refused to change the system or the way that things work. And basically said that if we paid attention to the way that race was played a role in sentencing, we'd have a flood of other people who wanted to talk about other disparities in terms of race or sex or of the defendants or of the attorneys or the judge or the justices in the criminal justice system. So that what Brian Stevens' analysis of the Powell decision was that it's too big to tinker with. We can't do anything about this. This is central to the way we administer justice in the United States, and there's nothing we can do about it.
So the defense actually used research to look at the racial disparity of how death sentencing was happening, and they use that in their case.
Yeah, they said that the research, which has been described as the most sophisticated study of the criminal justice system in the 20th century, found that the death sentence was applied 4.3 times more often when the murder victim was white. So, you know, they pointed to all these, and they said that in an 8-year period beginning in 1972, black defendants were nearly twice as likely to be sentenced to death as white defendants. So, you know, they did a scholar did this sort of careful research, identifying this kind of bias. And the court did not deny that the research was valid, but the court said basically there's nothing we can do. This opens a floodgate to other potential claims of bias, and we don't want to hear it.
And so these claims of bias, just how many people are imprisoned in the U.S., and what are the racial disparities in terms of those imprisoned?
Well, there are 2.3 million people imprisoned in the United States, and about 1 million are black. So there are just the disparities in terms of race and incarceration in the United States are huge. And by the way, I want to say that I really appreciate that you started the show talking about the kind of problems that Canada has with white supremacy and racial bias in sentencing. I really appreciate that because I was thinking about that as I, you know, as the time to do this interview approached. But there's just no question that, you know, there's tremendous, you can call it racial bias, you can also call it white supremacy, which I chose to do. So people of color are about 30% of the U.S. population, but are 60% of the imprisoned. And 1 in 3 black men will be touched by, you know, the correctional system at some time in their life. I think it's important to say, though, that it's not just black folks who are targeted, especially in terms of immigration issues. There's an explosion of Latinos in prison. And I think the same is true for white. I think in terms of the war on drugs, that there's also an explosion of white incarceration in terms of meth, you know, the sort of war on drugs and the way that meth has been played into that.
So there's an explosion of the prison population overall. It's not just a racial breakdown.
No, it's not just a racial breakdown, although in the United States you can't talk about class without talking about race. So it's very important to notice that black communities have been targeted and devastated by the war on drugs and by mass incarceration. But that's not the end of the story. And others are caught up in the logic, because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about social control, it's about racial control, and about the control of unemployed, formerly working-class people.
What are the impacts of this mass incarceration on society after people leave prison?
Well, the impact on societies and on specific communities is huge, and is completely devastating. So one thing is to sort of consider what it means for communities if a third of the men are somehow caught up in the criminal justice system. What that does to the sort of emotional and financial and cultural stability of a community where that's the case. So it's huge. There are issues about, particularly through the war on drugs, people who are convicted of drug offenses are denied access to the social welfare system, so public housing and food stamps and other forms of welfare. People who've been incarcerated have a very, very difficult time finding a job. So that communities in which there's sort of a vicious cycle, communities that are economically marginalized and people who might see the sort of drug economy as the only viable thing going on are further marginalized when they come out of prison and are not able to get even the low wage jobs that are available in communities. So the devastation is huge. I mean, one of the things I want people to be able to think about is that all this is really structural. The article I wrote for Al Jazeera had a lot of comments at the bottom of it, And I was sort of interested to see that many people wrote about how black people are just criminals, as if we are sort of inherently or essentially, you know, crime-ridden or crime-prone or something. So people need to think about it in terms of structure and in terms of how lack of access to the means to, you know, take care of yourself, to a job, drives this in very many ways, right? And so, and that's part of why we need to look at it in a historical sense, you know, and bring in questions of a legacy of white supremacy, right? A legacy of you know, black disenfranchisement and marginalization.
And I understand that it, for in many states, when you leave prison, you no longer have the right to vote, even.
That's right. In many states, that is absolutely right. That is the case. I think Brian Stevens, talking about Alabama, said that very shortly that the number of blacks who are disenfranchised is approaching the number of blacks who were disenfranchised before the Voting Rights Act. So, and I think that something like 13% of black men are disenfranchised because of their previous convictions.
And so in your article, you describe this mass incarceration and the history of slavery in the U.S. What is this connection?
Well, Michelle Alexander, the author of the brilliant book, The New Jim Crow, points out that there are many blacks in prison today as were enslaved in 1850 in the United States, a decade before the Civil War. What is important to recognize is the way that a whole community is sort of taken out, removed from the scene. So, like, for example, this is sort of a little digression, but when they do unemployment and employment figures for African Americans in the U.S., they don't count the imprisoned population. So, for example, if young black men are employed at a 33% rate, that doesn't include the ones that are in prison and that are sort of taken out of the official count. So there's a legacy of structural marginalization and exclusion from sort of the main economy, which is not doing so great for anybody, that is reflected in all of these things of issues about who is worthy, who counts, and those are all things that reflect this legacy of slavery that the United States has to deal with. And then, you know, unfortunately, sort of the right wing calls for, you know, cutting costs in the prison system don't deal with these issues. You know, so that we lose the opportunity to reflect on what this all means.
Well, thank you very much, Wendy, for joining us and illuminating this for us.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been speaking with Wendy Marshall, a cultural anthropologist working on issues of race, healing, and social change.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
पता क्यों नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अभी इसकी क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप। ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। चल समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
And deliver to those that's bitten too, but it's more than a bookstore. You want it, we got it. Mixtapes, DVDs, and culture products. Black and Nobel got our hands in a lot of projects. You rock them all to come build the energy, it's positive. And remember, of these teams, there's awakened conscious. Come through and experience this place of knowledge that they don't put it in a book. If they want to hide it from us, but we got the book, so you can buy it from us. Something to read while you're on a train or riding the bus. Get your read on, food for thought, get your eat on.
Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel.
black and gold bell. I bought my boots in black and gold bell. Black and gold bell. I bought my boots in black and gold bell.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year? Whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this the piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at FSRN.org.
This is Howard Zinn. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced false news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel, or under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While world powers fund and support Israel,
we,
the people of the world, in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights.
If I boycott Israeli goods,
it's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism. Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of a land. I reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew, simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
Oh. only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all
and those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
News in brief.
Some presidential comments causing a furor in Ottawa. The Watergate tapes show former President Richard Nixon held Prime Minister Trudeau in something less than high esteem, Paul Talbert reports.
Here at American embassy offices, there's a flutter over Nixon's statements. The fact he called the Prime Minister asshole Trudeau is embarrassing to the officials working across the street from Parliament Hill. Will there be an official apology from the American ambassador? No, I'm told. What was said in the Oval Office reflected Mr. Nixon's views.
This is Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Time we're hearing the 911 tapes of a woman who says she witnessed Tuesday night's in-custody death.
She says she saw everything, and Eyewitness News reporter Tom Murphy listened to the tapes and has more. Tom?
Caitlin, the Kern County Sheriff's Department turned the tapes over to us today. Our first chance to hear what witnesses were saying just moments after David Silva was restrained by several sheriff's deputies. He died shortly after that. Take a listen to the tape.
Sheriff's Office, how can I help you?
Yeah, your peace officer is over here on Flowers, and I think it's Tom, is it, what is it, Tom? There was a man laying on the floor, and your police officers beat the shit out of him and killed him.
The caller continued, saying the man had been unconscious, not breathing for at least 20 minutes. The caller says she had videotape from when the sheriffs first pulled up to when she called 911. She added she was right in front of where it all happened, and the sheriffs didn't have to do what they did.
You have 8 sheriffs. The guy was laying on the floor, and 8 sheriffs ran up and started beating him up with sticks. The man is dead, laying right here, right now. And I got everything on videotape. The man was not doing nothing. These cops have no reason to do this to this man.
And he asked for help. He was yelling for help. He was begging for help. No one came because the people that were supposed to help him were the ones killing him.
Animals. That's what they portrayed to be to me, because that's what they acted like.
That's how Jason Land describes the deputies he saw Tuesday night.
They jumped out, reached for their bats, poles, whatever you want to call it, beat that man till they killed him. Right in front of my face.
While sheriff's officials investigate a suspect's death in their custody, more questions are raised about what happened after that incident.
A witness we interviewed asks why he was arrested a few hours later, and a family asks why their cell phones were seized. Reporter Carol Ferguson has the latest.
Well, today we talked to the attorney that family hired. That lawyer was also contacted by the eyewitness we heard from yesterday. This all happened across from Kern Medical Center at about midnight on Tuesday. Officers say the suspect was reportedly intoxicated and he fought with the officers. They used batons to restrain him and he died later. 2 family members got cell phone video, and detectives arrived at their home a few hours later demanding the phones. Attorney John Tao says protocols must be followed. He questions why it took so long to get a search warrant, and keeping the family in their home for hours till the search warrant arrived. Melissa Cuellar says Her family wants the video to be available, and that's what they told officers.
We told them we weren't going to give them our phone. And they told us that it was evidence, and pretty much my house was a crime scene because we had the evidence.
I think they felt that they could intimidate these people in giving them their phones without the search warrant. And now they're holding the phones, and there's no reason to.
What are we supposed to do when we're witnessing a sheriff, police officer, whoever it may be that's, you know, works with the law, committing a crime like this, man? Who do we call?
He called Eyewitness News. Even before being interviewed, Jason said he was afraid of going on camera. After speaking up, he said he felt like he was being followed by deputies. He couldn't stop thinking about what he'd seen Tuesday night.
So what are they going to do to me? They'd do the same to me. I ran.
He said he ran to the nearest friend he could find, who drove him to the hospital.
If I wouldn't have said nothing, then cuss.
The 31-year-old who's on felony probation for domestic violence says he was arrested for being under the influence of PCP.
Under the influence of PCP, no test, no nothing. I was not under the influence of anything. I was scared for my life. I was paranoid.
Now he says he's being targeted.
I believe I'm going to be targeted for the rest of my life.
Land was released today and says he'll go home to his family.
I'm hiding. That's what I'm going to do. I don't trust outside. You know, when the people that are supposed to protect me, for people that do that without badges, the badges will do it too. Good. Can't do it.
He thinks there should be some consequences.
They deserve this. They don't deserve death, because I'm not God. I don't believe anybody deserves to die. But to be taken away to where they won't be able to do that again to anybody? They got the wrong one in cuffs.
Jason also said that he felt like there was an extended period of time between when he saw the man beat up and when the ambulances ultimately arrived. In studio, Tom Murphy, Eyewitness News. Caitlin, back to you.
Thanks, Tom. And we have more now on the man who died in custody, David Silva. We heard from his father last night. Today, Eyewitness News reporter Courtney Bryant spoke to Silva's brother. Courtney?
That's right. David Silva's brother, Christopher Silva, is in mourning, but that has not stopped him from speaking out. He says his brother was murdered at the hands of those who should have been fighting to save him.
David Silva is survived by four children, ranging from ages 2 to 10. They haven't yet learned of their father's death, but when they do, Christopher Silva wants them to hear the right story.
And I don't want them thinking or being told that my brother was just a bum on the street laying face down in the pool of his own blood. He was much more than that, and if anything, I want them to be able to know that their father meant a lot to a lot of people.
Christopher Silva says the memory of his brother will encourage him and his family to fight for justice.
And he asked for help. He was yelling for help. He was begging for help. No one came because the people that were supposed to help him were the ones killing him.
As the coroner's office is conducting an autopsy, the family has not yet been allowed to view the body. Christopher Silva says all he wants is to say goodbye one last time.
All I ask for is to see my brother's body. You know, I want to see what they did to my brother before they before anything is kind of hot hidden, you know, before anything is made up. I don't want anyone else to see. Just let me go in there and let me see my brother.
The coroner's office says an autopsy has been conducted, but results have not yet been released. We will, of course, be sure to bring you the latest as this story continues to develop. Back to you.